For another edition of the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchek. Thanks very much for spending some time with us this morning. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. We support the empowerment of doctors and patients through education. We support free market solutions to the healthcare problems facing us today, great as they are. So thank you very much for spending some time with us. This week I'm grateful to be sitting in one place for an hour this morning, and not having to move, not having to get up and run around, and not having to get up and go to the operating room. Not only is springtime a very, very busy time for us ear, nose, and throat doctors because of the pollen count, especially here in Atlanta and the Southeast, Atlanta being a very landlocked, temperature-inverted, humid city. Still a wonderful place to live, of course, but in the springtime, things can get pretty nasty, and we get very busy. In addition to that, from a personal standpoint, this week in the operating room has been particularly tough, and the surgeons in the audience will understand this when operations that appear to be for benign problems on the front end turn into malignancies during the procedure, and two-hour operations become six-hour operations, and at the end of that, and we've discussed this before, that surgery is a very physical, very sort of grueling sort of practice. But I'm kind of pooped. I'm kind of exhausted, so I'm kind of glad to be sitting here, especially with some great guests for the hour. We have Senator John Barrasso pre-recorded from yesterday that we'll be playing first in a couple of minutes, and then we will have Ed Hasselmeyer from the Heritage Foundation. So it should round out to be a very great hour and a relatively restful one for yours truly. So I'm very grateful. Today's topic will be the upcoming Supreme Court decision of King versus Burwell. Now, with the name, you can't really guess what that's all about. So for those of you that don't know already, we'll lay this out in the next 30 seconds or so before we cue up the interview with Senator Barrasso. But this is the latest of the court challenges to Obamacare. So, you know, if you get into the nuts and bolts of Obamacare, what you find is that if you go to either a state exchange or a federal exchange, and that's the crux of the problem, if your income is less than 400% of the poverty level, 100% through 400%, you qualify for subsidies based on a variety of very complicated factors and formulas, but you qualify for subsidies to support your premium costs. And the challenge comes because the law is written, if you read it and translate the English, that those subsidies should only apply to exchanges that are established by individual states. Well, as you know, 36 of our 50 states opted not to create a state exchange and allow folks to go to healthcare.gov, the federal exchange. Well, if you read the law, word for word as it's written, it only gives subsidies to state exchanges. And this was ignored by the administration, of course, and they instructed the IRS to simply do these subsidies for everyone regardless. So that's the crux of the problem is, how does the law get interpreted? Do people who go through the federal exchange, healthcare.gov, get subsidies or not? And with that, we're going to queue up the interview with Senator John Barrasso from Wyoming to get us started. Welcome to the Doctor's Lounge. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchek. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I alternate weeks with my inimitable co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, and I'm going to dispense with the remainder of the top of the show introductions because we have a very special, off-the-charts special guest for the first segment of the show this morning, Senator John Barrasso from Wyoming. John is one of the most popular congressmen around. He is known as Wyoming's doctor. He is a board-certified orthopedic surgeon, and he is popular with good reason. In 2012, he was reelected with over 75% of the vote, which is just off the charts. Senator, thank you for joining us today.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for having me today. It's a privilege to be with you.
Well, the privilege is all ours, Senator. Thank you very much. So today, I think we are charged with the subject of talking about an upcoming Supreme Court decision, one of the biggest ones coming down the pike this year, King versus Burwell, which is a very big decision for the survival or the success of Obamacare, and with that, I'm going to just transfer the baton to you and let you talk about that.
Well, no, I appreciate it, Mike, and you know this as a surgeon, and that this healthcare law that the president forced through Congress on a really party-line vote has been bad for patients, bad for providers, and bad for taxpayers, terrible for taxpayers. But we needed health care reform, just not this kind of health care reform. So the Supreme Court is going to be ruling a little later this year, probably the end of June, about the subsidies that go to pay for insurance. The law as written says that subsidies can only go to people that get their insurance through exchanges established by the states. Well, you know, 37 states said, no, we don't want to set up an exchange. So the president went around the law and said, well, we're going to send exchanges, send subsidies to these people anyway, told the IRS to do it. But this is just one of about 20 different ways that the president has unilaterally changed the law without coming to Congress to do it. So the Supreme Court is now hearing a case to say, is this legal? Are all of these subsidies that have been going out to the people in these 37 states where the law said they can't get subsidies, but they're getting them, what do we do? And that's the King versus Burwell case. If the Supreme Court rules that the president acted illegally, number one, that gives us an opportunity to try to get something onto the president's desk to force his hand in our effort to get people away from the health care law, get decisions away from Washington, have decisions made at the local level at home, because we know that one-size-fits-all approach to health care doesn't work. What works in Georgia does not necessarily work in Wyoming where I practice. Well, we do want to protect the people who've been harmed by the president's decision, but we don't want to protect the law. And that's what we're working on now. But I don't think any of us know what the Supreme Court is going to do, because everyone was so wrong in predicting what the Supreme Court would do last time. You know, people would say, was it constitutional or not? And the Supreme Court ruled that it was a tax and that Medicaid expansion would be voluntary. Nobody would have predicted how they ruled, so I don't think anybody has an idea what they're going to do this time either.
So let's assume for the moment, Senator, for the sake of argument, that they rule that the law really does say what the words say, which is that the exchanges, only exchanges established by the states, are eligible for subsidies, and those folks who went through healthcare.gov, some 7 to 8 million, depending on the source you look at, would have their healthcare insurance be in jeopardy because the subsidies would be withdrawn. Under that scenario, what, in your opinion, is the best response that Congress should have at that point?
You know, I think we need to protect the people, but not protect the law. And a number of us have endorsed and signed on to legislation that says, well, we'll for some period of time protect those people as we try to transition them out of the Obama health care law and get rid of some of these mandates, the employer mandate, the individual mandate, the so-called essential benefits package that, mandates that people buy a lot more insurance than many of them need or want or can afford. Ron Johnson's introduced that legislation. There are additional legislative packages that have been introduced. The key comes down to how to really get the health care reform that we need in this country. And I really don't believe, Mike, that we can get it until Barack Obama is no longer in the White House. So people say to me, well, just provide a replacement plan. Well, he's not going to sign that. They say, well, just put a repeal on his desk. Well, he's not going to sign that either. What we want to try to do is find a way to convince the president to sign legislation that will help protect the people while we can transition them back to the states where better decisions can be made for people's actual health.
So the key is for folks that may be getting a subsidy is don't panic if the Supreme Court rules that the current setup does not follow the letter of the law as it's written. You guys will be sure that everybody doesn't have their insurance jerked out from under them with a sort of a set of stopgap measures, and then that time will be used as sort of a lever to sort of rework things going forward between now and, say, 2016.
Well, that's right, Mike, and we don't know, because I was in the courtroom during the discussion of this I guess 2 months ago, and they said, well, they weren't even sure if they ruled the way that you and I just said, if it would go into effect immediately, if it would be delayed for a period of time to let Congress act. It could be as late as the end of the year, for all I know. So, yeah, I think there's no reason to panic. I think it's just a matter of if the court does what I think it should do, which is rule that the president acted illegally, there should be time for us to make sure that there's a transition for these folks away from the president's health care law and to something that works for them at the local level.
So implications for 2016, we'll look at both scenarios. Let's say that the court rules that no, it's not. It doesn't say how it's written. You know, the true intent was for everybody to get subsidies, and there's no immediate need created to fix things, and they all celebrate their victory, and we move on to 2016. What do you think happens then?
Well, a couple of things. One is I think that the president will try to force a lot more people onto the Obamacare exchanges, because right now there's about 5 million people or so that have bought insurance through the exchange. He's going to try to raise that number significantly, I think, to try to further ingrain the Obama health care law into society. I think it's still going to be a major issue in the campaign in 2016 in both Senate races as well as in the national race in the presidential race, because it continues to be very unpopular. It's still more people disapprove of the law than approve of it, and some of it breaks along party lines, but of kind of mainstream America, it's more people disapprove, and the reason is they think it's not a good program for them. They don't think it's a good bargain or a good deal for them personally. If they have insurance that they liked, many of them have lost it because of the change in the law, and now they're paying more money for insurance that maybe provides different care than they want, much has a higher deductible, higher copay, and higher premium, so they feel they haven't gotten such a good deal. The president puts a lot of people on Medicaid, a program that you and I as surgeons know doesn't really work all that well. Many doctors prefer not to see patients on Medicaid because the reimbursement is so low. So that's a failed system. We want to, that provides somebody with a Medicaid card, but doesn't actually mean they can get care. So the president, when you listen to him talk, keeps talking about providing health coverage, but you and I as doctors know there's a big difference between coverage and care, and I want to focus on getting people care, not empty coverage.
And so, in broad strokes, what's the general feeling amongst your Republican colleagues about how, if we get the ability in 2016 to really, really fix this? You know, there are some folks that from an emotional standpoint, want to write a one-page bill that says everything that was in the Affordable Care Act is null and void, and other folks who think that, you know, it has to be a more sophisticated kind of exit strategy. How are the winds blowing on Capitol Hill about that?
Well, a lot of we're going to have to wait and see what the court actually rules. We would like to replace the entire health care law, repeal and replace it with things that are patient-centered and patient-directed. And there are a lot of different good ideas to do that, but this president is not going to cooperate, I believe. And we'll have a chance to visit with that once we see the ruling. And I know I'm going to be on and have a chance to visit also at some point down the line on this show after the ruling actually comes forth. So I'm looking forward to doing that, Mike, and another, and I think that's probably going to be with Hal after the ruling comes in. But I do appreciate the chance to be with you today, and I hope that your listeners have found this helpful.
Thank you. We appreciate your time, Senator. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today. For our guest for the remainder of the show, we have one very special guest and one very nice guy, Ed Heiselmeyer. He is the Senior Research Fellow for the Center of Health Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, one of the leading thinkers in healthcare policy of all kinds, but has also written a great deal on the upcoming King versus Burwell decision. Ed, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Well, no, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, I'm just, as I promised, I'm just going to get out of the way and let you share with the listeners, you know, your thoughts on King versus Burwell, and I'm just going to be quiet. The microphone's yours.
Okay. Well, first off, I'm not a lawyer or an expert on the legality, you know, the interpretation issue. I mean, this is really a case of statutory interpretation. How should the court interpret what the Congress wrote? And I'm not an expert on that, so I won't get into that or speculating on how the court might rule. I can talk about, though, the implications for the healthcare system, depending on how it rules. And frankly, if the court were to uphold the administration's interpretation of the law, then not a lot would change. But the thing that has everyone interested is, what if the court were to rule that the interpretation that the administration has is incorrect, and that the law does not authorize the Treasury to pay Obamacare subsidies to people who get their coverage through an exchange that is not actually run by the state? That is where the effects would come in. So right now we have a situation where of the 50 states, 34 of them do not run their own exchange. The federal government, through the healthcare.gov website, runs an exchange for them. So the issue revolves around whether the law authorizes the Treasury Department to pay tax subsidies, tax credit subsidies, and cost-sharing subsidies to people who qualify for those subsidies but bought it through healthcare.gov.
So, yeah, just go ahead. I mean, there seems to be a lot of myths about what would happen if the court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and turned the subsidies off. What would happen?
Well, and some of this is maybe myth. Some of it is, frankly, that we don't have as precise information as we would like about the individuals who have obtained coverage and gotten subsidies. So, for example, we have some information that has been put out by HHS, but we don't really, for example, have a firm number for 2015, because all they've put out is how many people picked the plan, not how many people actually enrolled. Also, some of the data that they've put out may be incorrect, not necessarily intentionally. So, for example, they say that 83% of these people are below 250% of poverty, yet we see that from reports from H&R Block and other tax preparers that for 2014, a lot of those people actually wound up owing taxes because they underestimated their income. So for example, that figure that most of these people have low incomes may not entirely be true. And they just may not know that either. I mean, you know, people are underestimating their incomes, we don't know. But taking all that together, what we're looking at is about 7 to 8 million people maximum, it looks like, in the 34 states, who not only bought through the exchange, but are receiving some level of tax subsidy. And that gets to another issue, is from the data, we don't know exactly how many of those people are receiving a lot of subsidy, in which case, if the subsidies went away, it would be very difficult indeed for them to afford coverage. And we don't know how many of those people are receiving receiving very little subsidy, maybe a few dollars a month, because this subsidy system phases out.
So, but it's kind of a myth, though, that these folks aren't going to, if they rule in favor of the plaintiffs, the folks that are getting subsidies are not going to instantly have those subsidies jerked out from under them, right? I mean, the law's
well,
got
stuff.
That's
a whole other issue, yes. Okay. And that's what, and again, as I said, I'm not a legal expert on this, but I have read some things on the subject. So there are a couple schools of thought. One, and Justice Alito did raise this in the oral arguments, the possibility that the court could, in its ruling, stay the effect of its ruling for a period of time, say, till the end of the year, so that things wouldn't be disrupted in the middle of a plan year and the middle of a tax year. I have also read articles by law professors saying that, tax law professors, in fact, saying that, well, the court doesn't really even need to do that because the IRS, the Treasury, has the authority and has in the past just basically the authority to implement the effect of a court ruling at the start of the next tax year for much the same reason. So it is unlikely, possible, but unlikely that the subsidies would end immediately in the middle of 2015. The more likely scenario seems to be that it would, either through the court staying its order or the IRS exercising allowable discretion, that the system would shift at the end of the tax year, beginning of the next tax year, which would mean in January.
Okay. So in the event that we get a ruling for the plaintiffs, and you've written a lot about what you think Congress should do from a policy standpoint, so why don't we go there for a minute? And
well, this is the issue that is probably more front and center. I mean, you know, with the Supreme Court, what you have is a situation where they hear oral arguments on cases, and typically if the case is one where the court is fairly narrowly divided, then they will not rush an issue, an opinion out. There's a lot of back and forth as each side drafts, you know, the pro and the con drafts their opinions and their defense. And these get circulated among the justices. And sometimes even justices switch, you know, how they're going to vote on it based on being persuaded by the draft opinion. So in a case like this one, we actually had another case, the gay marriage case that had oral arguments the other day. In these sorts of cases, the court is probably going to wait until the end of June to issue their opinion. Now, where that leaves Congress is in a situation where they don't know what the opinion is going to be. It could very well be that the court says, yes, the plaintiffs are correct, the government's wrong, the subsidies can't be paid. And so the big issue going on now in Congress, and will continue for the next really month to almost 2 months, is, well, what should Congress be prepared to do if the court rules that the subsidies can't be paid? Now, the focus, not surprisingly, both in Congress and in the media, has been on the subsidies. But one of the points that we're trying to make, and actually I will have another paper coming out shortly on that, is that if you look at the design of this legislation, in large part, the subsidies are there because the legislation started off by imposing regulations on insurance plans that drove up the cost of coverage. So, logically, if you have a situation where first they made coverage more expensive and then they subsidized it, if you reverse that and say, well, there aren't subsidies, well, then you need to start by getting rid of the things that drove up the cost of coverage in the first place. So that's the position that we've been trying to get folks in Congress to see and understand, that, look, if you're talking about what to do with the subsidies only, you're not really addressing the underlying issue here. The underlying issue here is that this legislation made coverage more expensive for millions of people. And the other point that is relevant for members of Congress in this is administration made coverage more expensive for millions of people who, even if you accept the administration's interpretation of the law, don't qualify for subsidies. So in other words, the pool of people who would be affected by Congress removing the regulations that drove up the cost of insurance and thus be affected by getting their insurance premiums back down is much larger than the pool of people that would be losing subsidies here. And furthermore, with respect to that second group, if you bring the cost of coverage back down first, then when you go to discuss, well, how many people still need subsidies and what sort of subsidy design, you know, should we do, what should we give them? Well, you're going to have a smaller group of people and you'll probably need less money to do it, simply because you made it cheaper. So that's, it's really a question of how Congress sequences going about this. I think, and I may be overly optimistic, but I think it is possible that Congress could use that as a template for negotiating a bipartisan bill that says, look, if you're in a state that doesn't get these subsidies, then you and the insurers in your state, you don't have to comply with the things that drive up the cost of coverage substantially. And then we'll talk about sort of how we might replace subsidies for people who lost coverage. And you could do it in the same bill or you could do it subsequently. One of the things that I note, by the way, is that of the 34 states that would potentially have the subsidies go away in those, for those residents, they are collectively 20 of their, well, they're 34 states, so that would make up 68 senators. Of those 68 senators, 20 of them are Democrats. And six of them are Democrats who were not in Congress, who were not either in the House or Senate when Obamacare was passed, and thus they have no vote on Obamacare, no passed vote to defend or reconcile. So I may be a little optimistic, but I think there is room there for, in the Senate, a negotiating sort of bipartisan bill to address some of these issues.
So two questions, and one is, you know, if we get it through, you know, the House and the Senate, what happens when something like that goes to the president's desk?
Ah, well, that gets very, very interesting, and a lot of people just automatically assume the president will veto that, but I can understand why. And again, I'm trying not to be too optimistic, but I'm still trying to look for opportunity here, and I'm not so sure if you craft it the right way that he can get away with that. Because here's the problem. He would be put in a position he's not been in and not comfortable, therefore, being in, of being potentially trying to veto something that could be quite popular, and it would clearly harm people if he vetoed it. It would harm identifiable people if he vetoed. See, remember, for 6 years, Senator Harry Reid, as majority leader of the Senate, as long as the Democrats controlled the Senate, for 6 years of President Obama's term so far, Senator Harry Reid effectively protected him from ever having to make a decision like that, because the bill that would have been like that never got out of the Senate. I think the one that's most instructive on this is to look at what happened at the beginning of the year. As soon as the Republicans took over the Senate, what bill did they move? They moved that Keystone Pipeline bill, right?
Right.
And how did they do it? They took the House bill, they took it up to the Senate, and Senator McConnell, the new majority leader, put it on the floor and allowed Democrats to amend it. And there was a real debate, and there were real amendments, and some of the amendments proposed by Democrats got put on the bill. They got approved. And, you know, I think they sort of mischievously, you know, tweeted out that in the first week they'd done more amendments on the floor of the Senate than they'd done in the entire previous 2 years, because he unstopped that. And so when it was done, they sent the bill back to the House, and that put Speaker Boehner in a better position, because he can then go to even the most conservative members of the House and say, look, we sent them a bill that you like. They amended it with the Democrats on the Senate floor. You know, so now it's a bipartisan bill. This is about as far as we can get.
Ed, I I'm going to stop you mid-sentence. I'm going to stop you mid-sentence there. We're right up on a hard break. We're going to pick this up right in the middle of the same sentence after the break. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your health care freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchek. Thanks so much for joining us or staying with us. We have as our very special guest this morning, Ed Heiselmeyer, who is the Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Health Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And Ed, before I had to sort of cut you off for the break, we were talking about the Keystone Pipeline bill as kind of a process template for what might be able to be used as a bill to get to Obama's desk regarding Obamacare, depending on the Supreme Court decision coming up.
Yeah, and my point is simply that we see with the Keystone Pipeline bill that the Congress was able to function. They were able to, in the end, get a bipartisan bill with 60-some votes in the Senate, and then the House accepted that. They said, look, yeah, that's as good as we're going to get, and they sent it to the president's desk. What was interesting about that is two things. One, the president did veto it, but he did it quietly. There was no fuss. Why? Because there was no political advantage to him. All the politics was on the other side. Two, he was able to get away with the veto, I think, simply because the harm caused by his veto was theoretical in the future. In other words, by vetoing the bill, by not allowing the pipeline to go forward, there's some unknown number of jobs that will not be created in the next year or two. Well, that's kind of theoretical. Now, imagine the same sort of scenario, but on fixing the health care law. So you pass a bill in this House, you send it to the Senate, you put it on the floor, Senator McConnell, the majority leader, puts it on the floor, allows Democrats to amend it. You get a bipartisan result. You get Democrats voting for the bill. The bill gets at least 60 votes in the Senate. It goes back to the House. The House says, well, that's as good as we're going to get, and the Republican majority passes it in the House, and so then they send it to the president. Now the president's in the same situation as with Keystone, but here's the difference. The difference is if he vetoes this bill, then real people out there will suffer because he's essentially saying, no, I won't accept Congress's fix. Congress has to accept only my fix, and until such time as they do, people will just have to suffer. They'll have to go without the subsidies or whatever. That puts him, I think, in a politically much more difficult position than when he vetoed the Keystone bill, and the only argument you could really make about it was, well, that means some jobs won't be created in a few years, but we don't know who would get those jobs or where they would be.
Gotcha. And in fact, if I understand you correctly, the people who would be hurt would be his constituents.
Well, that's probably largely true, because to the extent that people are getting subsidies on the exchange, they tend to be people with lower incomes. So, you know, given the general voting patterns, they're probably more likely to vote Democrat than Republican, I suppose. So that maybe it's the truth to that.
Gotcha. So do you have any thoughts about what Congress should do and what they shouldn't do in terms of, you know, when they're making the sausage to create this bill?
Yes, and that's kind of the thing that we're coming out with next. We alluded to it in earlier papers, and that is to remove some of the things, to start by saying, the first step is to bring the cost of coverage back down. I mean, let's remember that this legislation, Obamacare, increased people's coverage costs and then provided subsidies. So if the subsidies go away, let's reverse that and bring down the coverage costs first before we discuss any replacement design for subsidies. So to that end, we mentioned three particular areas that we see as driving the costs up, and that's what our next paper expands upon in a bit more detail. Specifically, the essential benefits and preventive services benefit mandates. These are new federal insurance benefit mandates that were imposed on top of state benefit mandates to create a sort of standardized package of benefits across the country. At the time that this was going into effect, this took effect in 2014, so at the time, back in 2013, a number of states commissioned actuarial firms to analyze what the effects of these and other changes would be on their insurance markets and on pricing for insurance. Now, these benefit mandates, the effect of the new federal benefit mandate package in surveying the actuarial studies, we found was on average that it increased premiums about 9% across the board. So that's kind of what concluded after reviewing the actuarial studies that had been done in the literature. Now, that will vary based on states. In a state like, say, Maryland, which had a lot of benefit mandates already, and therefore there wasn't as big a gap between what it already had and the new federal standard, that may be, it looks like, from that actuarial study, about 3 or 4% increase, whereas in other states that had fewer benefit mandates, it'll be more than 9%, could be as much as 17%, according to one actuarial analysis. Be that as it may, we see that removing those benefit mandates, exempting the states that don't have exchanges from those benefit mandates, exempting the insurers and their customers, would lower the cost of coverage by about 9%. Now, that would be across the board for all the coverage. The other, a second one, is to adjust the age rating. You know, as you well know, as a physician, and I'm sure many listeners would as well, as people get older, they use more medical care as a rule. And so when you look at the distribution of health care expenses by age for adults, and we're just going to look at the range here of, adults from, say, 21 to 64, because after 64, it's really a separate issue with Medicare. But if you look at that distribution of expenses for non-retired adults, then what you find is the distribution is about 5-1, meaning your pool of 64-year-olds will, on average, consume about 5 times as much medical care as your pool of 21-year-olds. Now, what the law did is to say, well, but you can't charge premiums that vary by more than 3-1. So that had the effect of bringing down the premiums a little bit for people who are, say, between 55 and 64, but it raised them a great deal for people who are between 21 and 30. And the problem with that is twofold. One, the people's incomes tend to increase with age as well. Because when you start out, particularly in your early 20s, you don't make very much. It's only as you gain experience and skills in whatever your chosen field is that you start to make more money. So younger people don't have as much money. They also, because they're healthier, are less likely to spend what money they do have on health insurance, and that's why that is the population that is most likely to be uninsured, the 20-somethings. So, in effect, to artificially constrain the premiums and raise the premiums for young adults, it makes the issue, makes the task of covering the uninsured more difficult. So that would be the second thing we would do, is we would change the age rating. We would remove that restriction. We would say Congress should remove that restriction in those states. Let the states go back to figuring it out on their own, because remember, states have been regulating insurance for well over a century. And assuming that states sort of, you know, redid their laws or reverted to laws that, that set the parameters at 5-to-1, we're looking at dropping coverage costs for the young adults by about a third, about 33%. Finally, the third thing is that there is something called a minimum actuarial value standard. And this is technical, but basically actuarial value is, okay, given the benefits provided by the policy, what share of that, what percentage of those would on average for a group, typical group of people be paid by the policy, by the insurance plan, versus paid by the patients out of pocket? So a 60% actuarial value plan, which is what the standard is for these so-called bronze plans, and that's sort of the floor, that would mean that for a typical population, for that policy, you would expect that the, collectively among the population, the policy would pay out 60% of, would cover about 60% of what they spend on health care, with the patients covering the other 40% with, you know, out-of-pocket with deductibles, co-pays, et cetera. And what that did was it meant that not all plans, it didn't force all plans up, but by setting that floor, it forced up the lowest-cost plans. So the lowest-cost plans had to meet that new higher floor. That raised premiums by about 8%, from what we can tell in the actuarial studies. Interestingly enough, most of the plans that didn't meet the standard, they were between a 50, 60% actuarial value. And even supporters of Obamacare have talked about addressing the cost by what? Creating a new lower actuarial value copper plan at around 50%. So this would be effectively the same. So when you look at all of that, you put it together, we are coming out with a paper, we estimate that on the lower end of the age scale, like the people who are 21 to 24, premiums could be reduced by about 44% from where they are, from the level of a bronze plan today. And on the upper end of the scale, somebody, people who are 64, from where the bronze plan's premium are today, the lowest cost premium could be 7% less.
So, I mean, from an intuitive standpoint, then, it would seem that if you could implement all these fixes, you would almost largely eliminate the need for subsidies, or at least drastically cut it back?
But what you would do is you would make coverage much more affordable for the younger adults who are the ones most likely to be uninsured. Keep in mind, why would young adults be more likely to be uninsured? Well, there are basically three reasons. One, they're as a rule healthy, so they don't feel they need it. Two, they make less money, so they, you know, have real, you know, even a cheap premium, you know, why would I buy health insurance when I could buy something else? It's just not a priority for their limited resources. And three, many of them, if not most of them, are, particularly those who are, say, ages 21 to 25, are single. They're not married. They don't have families. A lot of times with these purchasing decisions, they will change when somebody gets married and has a family. I mean, why would somebody who's 23 and single buy health life insurance? There's no reason to.
Exactly.
But if you get married, if you have a spouse that you're concerned about, especially if you have children, then things like life insurance and health insurance become much more important.
They have to protect your house and all that stuff.
You would lower costs for people who are most likely to be uninsured.
Okay, that's. We're going to break right there. We're going to take our last break, and then we'll go to the last segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thanks so much for sticking with us. The last segment, we've got some neat stuff planned here. We are talking with our special guest, Ed Heiselmeyer, Senior Research Fellow for the Center of Health Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And once again, when I had to cut Ed off mid-sentence talking about the reasons why young people are really disincentivized to buy insurance until they get a little older and they get married and have a spouse and a house to protect and children to protect, that, you know, they kind of stand alone as kind of a unique population whose insurance needs are much lower.
That's right, and that's why they're much more sensitive to premiums and pricing. So your initial question about this was, well, if you removed a lot of these insurance regulations, would there still be a need for subsidy? And my point is simply that for younger people, the need would be much less. It's not about subsidy. It's about, you know, if you bring the premiums down, it's just making sure that they understand it's a good value proposition. That said, there are people, particularly in the pre-retirement age, who have maybe either retired early or lost a full-time job or things like that, people who are in their late 50s, early 60s, and they are expected to insure. And to the extent that there are some people like that who are not at the top of their earning years, and there are people like that, not the majority, but there are some. Those are the people who are probably going to really require some kind of assistance and subsidies going forward.
So the whole concept of one of the concepts of Obamacare was this idea that we put everybody sort of into one big pool. We make the young people sort of pay over a lifetime so that when they're older and they need insurance, they've sort of, at some ethereal conceptual level, been paying in for a while, and then, you know, almost like a Social Security type model. You know, you've outlined some very good reasons, I think, why, you know, that concept kind of falls apart.
Well, it does, and you know, it's an attractive concept. Believe me, I've thought about it too, but the because if you look at pensions or you look at life insurance, I mean, think about life insurance. Life insurance, we're all going to die, right? So how could anybody possibly insure you against dying? Because we all know you're going to die. Well, the way they insure you, they don't insure you against dying. What they do is they create a mechanism where they say, down the road, you know, when you die, this is what the benefit will pay out, and we have a premium that you pay in going forward. Now, here's the problem with health care. With life insurance, we can do that because we just set as X the dollar amount down the road. It could be anything from $10 to $10 million, right?
Sure. Yeah.
But we don't know what X is. See, we don't know. We could, in theory, do that for your lifetime health expenses, either private insurance or a public program, if we knew that when you died, at that point, we would know that your lifetime total health expenses were X. But how do we know that? There's no way to know that, because unlike life insurance, where you're just dealing with, you know, some fairly basic things, a fixed amount of money and assumptions about you know, inflation over 50, 60 years and things like that. With healthcare, I mean, look how much the technology is changing from year to year. So that's the problem. You can't really come up with that kind of model, as attractive as it would be, for something where you don't know what the endpoint's ever going to be.
Well, I mean,
and that's the difficulty we have in this.
Well, I think it's related to the concept that, health insurance is not true insurance. It's a benefit program, right? I mean, life insurance,
well,
especially term insurance.
And I think that's one of the ways we're going to be coping with this in the future, because there's a lot of, and that's the other thing I think that's important about reforming this legislation. You know, here's the problem with these kinds of bills is that they sort of take what we know today and what people think ought to be and then write it into legislative stone, if you will. And we see that both in this country and abroad. I mean, I like to joke that the British National Health System, which was created in 1948, delivers the world's finest system of 1940s medicine, because that was what it was all built around. If you think about the Medicare program in this country, why was it that Medicare didn't have prescription drug coverage until 2003? Well, because the legislation, the program, was originally created in 1965, when prescription drugs were a minor expense that people just paid out of pocket, because there weren't a lot of prescription drugs. There were a few antibiotics and some sulfur drugs and things like that, right?
Yes.
So that's the problem. You don't want to foreclose innovation. Now, on the innovation front, I think what I see coming forward is employers, a couple of big trends. Employers will move to defined contribution, giving their workers more choice of plans. It won't be this sort of one-size-fits-all that we're used to in employer coverage. I see also on the provider side the growth of direct primary care payment arrangements with specialty hospitals, things like that. I see that what you will wind up with is potentially, particularly with primary care, you could wind up in a situation where down the road the norm would be that you join a primary care practice and you pay a monthly fee for you and your family, and anytime you need a doc to see to something, or you have a regular checkup or whatever, you go there. And these would be multidisciplinary primary care practices, probably, you know, internists, OBGYNs, pediatricians, etc. And you would pay for it like you would your cable bill or your phone bill on a monthly bill. No fee for service, no bureaucracy, and you would have insurance in case you or one of your family members had a condition where you had to go and see a specialist or get some specialized treatment or get some surgery, or you were, you know, in an auto accident or went to a hospital, whatever. I could see that model evolving, and I think it's very interesting to watch that space right now.
So yeah, that's one of our big causes, and our president Lee Gross, whom you may have met last month,
yep.
You know, is having some great success down in Florida with Epiphany Healthcare, which is his group, and he's having some great success, you know, pushing through some legislation to sort of protect that model. But this is kind of off what we talked about in advance, but I'll put you on the spot a little bit. I mean, what legislative changes regarding Obamacare would be required to make something like that relatively immune to challenges that, you know, these are doctors providing insurance, or it fails to meet Obamacare minimum requirements or whatever?
Actually, in this case, the issue really isn't Obamacare. The big issue, really the most significant one, and we're seeing this happen, I know your organization has been involved in it and others, the big issue is state law, and here's why. Until Obamacare came along, states pretty much, states have historically regulated insurance of all kinds. They've done it for well over 100 years, and by and large a pretty good job of it, too. And there are good reasons why you have to regulate insurance. It's not just the, you know, insurance is a kind of funny market. I mean, if you think about it, what other market do you have to protect, not only protect the consumers from the producers or suppliers, but protect the suppliers and producers from the consumers?
Yes.
You know, think about the insurance company that insures your house, and then you decide to burn it down to collect the insurance. you really need sort of more regulation and balancing in this area than in a lot of other areas. That said, the issue at the state level with respect to direct primary care is, what's the threshold where a person or an organization becomes what is known in insurance law as a risk-bearing entity, meaning they're accepting risk in exchange for fee, which is the fundamental definition of insurance. In other words, how much risk do you have to take on before you become an insurance carrier? So in a retainer or subscription payment system, say you're being paid a monthly fee by the patient, and the fee is calculated on an expectation of a certain number of visits per year, and the patient may have more, the patient may have less. So to a certain extent, you as the physician are taking on a bit of a risk. But yes, but is it a big risk? Is it a significant risk? Does it rise to the level that you should be regulated as an insurer? And I think the answer quite clearly is no. But the problem is, absent somebody raising the issue, it may just not have been thought about. So that's what's going on in state legislatures, is to say, well, we may need to go back and tweak these laws to make it clear, to make it unambiguous when this situation arises, that no, you're not going to regulate that practice as an insurance company just because there's a little bit of marginal and quite manageable risk. Because that's not what state insurance law is about. They're not just trying to regulate risk for the sake of risk. They're trying to regulate to make sure that if these contracts between somebody, and their insurer, to make sure that these contracts actually work. In other words, the reason they regulate risk is if the insurer says, well, you pay me a fee, I'll take the risk. Well, yeah, but is the insurer capable of performing? If they promise you that they're going to cover your losses, do they have the money to do it? Well, that's legitimate, but that's not what's going on here. So what you need is laws to carve this out, and that's what's been going on. I know your organization was involved in doing that in Michigan. I was just hearing somebody else that's been done in Idaho. There's a number of states, and so that's one big one. The other thing is also the same issue in federal law. In federal law, basically clarifying that this kind of arrangement is not to be treated as insurance. It's to be treated as just a different way of paying your doctor. And that's a little unclear in the tax law, but that's important because if we clarify that in the tax law, then it becomes very clear that, for example, if you have a health savings account, you can use the money in your health savings account to go and buy on a fee-for-service basis the same services from that physician, but you can't do it on a subscription basis if doing so on a subscription basis is treated as supplemental insurance, which it really isn't, but that's kind of the ambiguity. So those are the places where the law needs to be clarified.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, my impression is that, conceptually you're splitting healthcare into its true insurance component, right, by risk, for a fee, versus, the routine parts of healthcare, which is the well checkups and all the stuff that don't really fit a risk profile because everybody's going to use them eventually.
Yeah, and the other thing is that there's an extension of this even into more specialized, more expensive.
Unfortunately,
care.
We're done. We're at the top of the hour, and it's a hard break. So thanks so much. I so appreciate it. This was Ed Haselmeyer from Heritage Foundation. You've been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.